You're listening to the Winsight Podcast Network.
Take your industry insights to the next level by becoming a restaurant business subscriber. Go to restaurantbusinessonline.com, click on the blue subscribe button in the upper right-hand corner, enter promo code PODCAST23, that's PODCAST23, to get your first month of RB Basic for free. After promo period, current rates apply. And now, please enjoy this episode of Menu Feed.
Welcome to Menu Feed, a weekly podcast from Restaurant Business and Food Service Director. I'm Pat Kobe, Senior Editor covering menus, chefs, food, and drink for both brands. Joining me on the podcast is Troy Hooper, CEO of Pepper Lunch, an Asian fast casual with hundreds of locations around the world, including several in the U.S., with big plans to grow domestically. Hooper works with small and emerging brands to help scale and enhance their businesses. And right now, he's focused on Pepper Lunch. He's engaged in a menu re-engineering exercise and is taking a hard look at supply chain, pricing, and ingredient specs. Pepper Lunch was founded by a Japanese master chef, and its big selling point is maintaining that connection to authenticity. Its signature is a dish called beef pepper rice, served Lazy Susan style in family homes in Japan. Pepper Lunch pared down this family-style dish to a personal-sized iron plate that's uniquely designed so the food can be cooked teppanyaki style on the plate by each guest. The ingredients are the same as those used in Japan, but in the U.S., the menu also includes items done nowhere else: French fries, sweet potato wedges, and tempura fried onion rings. Listen as Troy describes how Pepper Lunch got its name, how the concept is differentiating the Asian fast casual space, how this low-labor, low-waste model meets today's challenges, and how he's planning to grow off-premise business and expand to both traditional and non-traditional locations. Welcome, Troy. Thanks so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Pat. Really glad to be here.
Yeah, same here. Well, let's begin by you telling me a little bit about your professional journey that brought you to Hot Palette Holdings and Pepper Lunch.
From busboy to CEO, I grew up in on a construction site. My father built one of his construction companies, built restaurants, nightclubs, and golf courses and things like that. So a lot of hospitality, grew up, spent a lot of time in hotels and those types of environments. And I thought I wanted to be a chef. So became a busboy, of course. You got to be a busboy or a dishwasher first, and worked my way up. Eventually went to culinary school as a young man, and sort of dual majored between culinary and college. And all through college, I cooked for about 6 years. After culinary school, I went to business school, followed the entrepreneurial spirit that my family set in front of me, and got onto the sort of hospitality management track. You know, came up through fine hotels and fine dining restaurants, private clubs, and Caribbean resorts. After a number of years working my way up through management, I started a consulting firm, and I started off in hotels, private clubs, resorts, and golf clubs. In the turnaround business, helping distressed and failing businesses turn around using a focus on culture and solid business metrics and new profit centers. And about 7 years ago, I've always just had a heart for restaurants. And about 7 years ago, I partnered up with my partner, Mark Bailey, and we created a division of my hospitality company called Kiwi Restaurant Partners. Mm-hmm. And that's what we've done, really focused on ever since. We wound down the management business over a few years. And we focused on small and emerging brands, working with founder and operator groups to help them scale their business at greater speed, but also while improving the quality of the brand, the operations, basically everything. We're a one-stop shop to take a concept. And about 80% of the time, we franchise it. And that's how Pepper Lunch found us. We have a great legacy of helping a number of brands get off the ground and get retooled and get ready for growth. And they found us in hopes of helping them in North America predominantly. And as a result of that, they asked me to come on board as CEO and have Kiwi Restaurant Partners as the infrastructure developer and manager. And it's a great two-sided coin. We serve the company on both capacities from the brand perspective and from the franchisee franchisor relationship perspective. And it's been a great marriage for about a year.
So are you involved in the menu part of it at all, since you do have culinary background?
Yeah, absolutely. We're actually in a menu re-engineering exercise that just kicked off in the last few weeks, and we're going to wrap it up early in Q1. We're going to make some minor tweaks now to pricing and selection, but really take a hard look based on our supply chain development that we've done here in North America, really take a hard look at our costs and our new negotiated prices across the United States and Canada, and roll out an updated menu. I don't expect drastic changes. I think we're looking at portion, we're looking at specification of ingredients, we're certainly dialing in our suppliers, and then ultimately I think price is where the biggest lift is going to have to be in regards to really being thoughtful about where we fit. Pepper Lunch is unique in that we're well above the fast casual average price point of that $10.50 to $12.50, but we're well under casual because our average plate goes out the door at $17.50. So we kind of sit in a space all our own right in the middle.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you, is the service style more fast casual or full service? Because it seemed like
fully kind of a hybrid. Fast casual. Yep. Kiosk or counter order taker, just like any other fast casual. About a 5 to 7 minute delay from the time you order to the time the food's brought to you. At peak, we hit about 10 to 12 minutes. So true fast casual, we do give a little bit of table side service in regards to some explanation about the sauces and the process and how to experience your food well. We certainly come around and we'll check on you, but you're serving your own beverages. We're bringing the food to you from the kitchen after you order it. So yeah, we really fit in that fast casual venue model style.
Well, tell me how it differs from concepts like Genghis Grill and BD's Mongolian Grill, because when I was reading some background on it, it sounded like some of the, you know, the preparation style is kind of the same and some of the ingredients might cross over a bit too.
Yeah, there's some similarities. Here's the core difference is that we were founded 30 years ago by a Japanese master chef in Tokyo, Japan, and he owned the company for 27 of our 30 years. Sold it in 2020 to a private equity group again from Japan. And the team that has been running this company have been with the company. We have most of our executives and leadership throughout the world have been with the company for more than 15 years. We have a number of folks that have been with us for 20 to 25 years. So I'd say the biggest thing is legacy, is authenticity. Yeah, I think it's really maintaining connectivity to our authenticity throughout those years. Through the legacy team carrying the torch. We've remained very true. One thing that's really fun about our brand is that about 80% of our menu is the same everywhere in the world, but we do allow for, and this is not a formula we follow, it just kind of fell in that way, but we do allow for regional adaptation to bring in the flavors and the textures and the spices from a local, as long as it's living up to sort of the core premise of the concept. But we're not down the line. We're not build your own bowl. You're picking from a menu. You get to modify those items on the menu to your wishes. We have lots of fun things we call add-ons. So cheese and onions and mushrooms and, you know, kimchi or things like this that you can enhance and change the flavor of the recipe. But at the end of the day, you're ordering off a menu, sitting down, we're bringing it to you. So a little bit different from those other concepts. And primarily I focus back on the fact that really founded by an actual master chef in Tokyo, Japan, who maintained ownership for so long. We really have never lost that core depth of authenticity that we were born with and that we carry today.
Right. Well, since you're expanding in the U.S. now, you now have 5 locations. Is that correct?
Yeah, we have 5 continental U.S. locations. We have 1 in Guam. That gives us 6 actual U.S. locations. And we have 1 in Vancouver, Canada. So we have 7 in North America today.
Okay. So since you've come to North America, are you swapping in some more Americanized ingredients in some of the dishes? I mean, if you can give me some specifics about some of the ingredients that you might have you know, made more regional since you've been here?
There are only three items that we do in America that we don't do anywhere else. And that is the fried foods. We are have fantastic, and everybody, Josh can call to this. We have fantastic onion rings, amazing onion rings. They're tempura battered onion rings. They're really good. We have French fries, which are fantastic, kind of a unique thicker cut fry. And then we actually have these sweet potato wedges, kind of like traditional home fry style sweet potato wedges. And they're really just kind of meaty, and they're not those soggy, thin little things. That's the only thing that's unique to the American menu. We've not Americanized it. We do not want to, quote, Americanize it. You know, we are trying to show the North American market what authentic in-home Japanese teppanyaki style family meals look like. Because this is founded on a dish called beef pepper rice. And beef pepper rice is a family style dish served in about a 20 to 22 inch iron skillet and served family style in the center of the table on a Lazy Susan. And so they put this big iron skillet on the range at home, use all four burners to heat it up, of course, fill it with rice and vegetables and meats and the garlic soy sauce to marinate it. And then they put it on the table and everybody cooks their meat. It sort of that faces them. That's a little section to their liking, and then scoops up the rest of those ingredients. We've taken that family style dish and just pared it down to a 12 inch personal plate. Ultimately, that's all we've done. And so it's really important to us that we stay true to that base or foundation of our concept, and that we bring those flavors to the world. Now, of course, we've done that really well throughout Asia, and we've been in Australia for 14 years, and we've now been in the United States for 5.5 years. So we're starting to see that adoption and understanding of the concept, and it's just really crave-worthy food, right? It's just delectable food that you, after you've had it once or twice, you find yourself, when can I go back to Pepper Lunch? So we really enjoy that connectivity with the guest and the connection that they make to the flavor and the experience and the hospitality all together.
And then there's also an interactive element to it, because even though it's an individual dish, the customer finishes it on his own. Is that correct?
Yeah. So we bring everything to you raw on the plate. Now, nothing is cooked. The rice is obviously made, but everything else is raw except for chicken. Is the only thing we bring to you that's sous vide, pre-cooked, to make sure you're not getting any raw chicken product. But you are actually the master chef. That's what we say, is our guest is the master chef. We want you to sizzle it your way. This is called DIY teppanyaki. So the idea is that you're going to cook it to the temperature of your liking, the sizzle of your liking, the friedness of your liking, and then add one of our five signature sauces if you like or not. And again, with those add-ons like garlic chips and onions and vegetables and things, you can really, really make this combination any way you like. So it really is, the end product is really in the guest's hands. We're just setting you up with the right portion and the right items that you want in that dish. And then ultimately you're cooking it yourself on the 500 degree iron plate that sits in front of you.
Sounds really cool. So are the units in the U.S. sourcing from domestic suppliers, or do they have to source from Asian, because you are trying to be as authentic as possible? So I'm curious about the supply
chain. Yeah, it's a great question. It's a really solid mix. So what most people in America don't realize is that Japan imports about 90-95% of its beef from North America. So we actually export most of our beef to Japan. And so it's really the other way around. We're actually using the beef in the U.S. that we normally ship overseas. So that's pretty fascinating. But yes, there's a number of proprietary products. Mostly our sauces. We bring all of our sauces over from Asia. We bring our corn over from Asia. We bring our black pepper over from Asia. Now, some of those are going to change. It's quite remarkable that several of our purveyors, like the sauce makers that make our sauces in Japan, actually have manufacturing here in Los Angeles and in Phoenix, Arizona, go figure. And so we're actually beginning the process of switching our production for those sauces to our North American, but it's the same company. It's the exact same recipe, exact same source ingredients, et cetera. They're just going to make them here locally for us so that we're actually extending the life of, you know, shelf life of these products, which are shelf stable for the most part, except for our cream sauce. And so it's a healthy mix. The things that we believe are really core and the flavors and the quality we believe are greater when they come from Asia, we're bringing here. And then, of course, there's many domestic items that we export to Asia. And so those, of course, are staying closer to home.
Right. And do you have trained chefs at each location, or do you really allow the customer to be the chef and you just need trained people at each location?
Yeah. So this is one of the unique things about our concept is that we are both a low labor and no skilled labor model. You do not have to have any skilled labor staff in the house. No prep cooks, no line cooks, no sous chefs or chefs of any kind in your organization, because we are not actually cooking anything. We make one product in the building, and that's rice. And we've automated that to a machine with three buttons. So at the end of the day, the rice is extremely consistent. It takes 10 to 15 minutes. You don't have to have any skill to make it correctly or make it consistently. Everything is coming in the back door, pre-spec from our purveyors to our very, very specific requirements. And we have tremendous quality control and quality assurance programs and policies and staff. And but yeah, in the store, there's no prep hours. You're not actually chopping, dicing, slicing anything. You're not cooking or making anything. All you have to be able to do is take it out of a package fresh, put it on your station, measure it for portion control to order, and assemble on the plate. Put that plate in the window, send it out to the guest, and let the guest do the rest.
That sounds really interesting. And so do you have to, they don't have to like slice up vegetables or anything. You get them already pre-prepped.
Everything comes in completely done from our commissary and purveyors in the back door, vacuum packed by small portion size. So we have virtually no waste. We almost can't even measure our wastage because we've got this down to a pretty solid science on volume control. The reality is something that I found very interesting after 31 years in this industry is I don't know if I've ever found another brand or concept that has such steady sales overall that we sell almost exactly the same number of plates every day. So I can tell you by store what their average cover count by day and by month is. And the movement on that is a couple of percentage points up or down. There's really not a lot of sway. That being said, we are seeing year over year growth, but that growth is almost equally consistent across all stores. So when we see growth in the brand, we're seeing brand wide growth lift overall, but we're not seeing these spikes at specific stores or drops in specific stores. It's really just sort of an increased brand awareness drives growth for us. But extremely predictable volume. So it really helps with our inventory control, waste management.
Well, this was a curious question I had on my part with the name, you know, with the word lunch in the concept's name. Do people come in for dinner too, or do they just come in for lunch?
I love that question. It is actually the first question I asked my Japanese counterpart when he came to visit me in Los Angeles and talk about this brand. I said, Peppered lunch. Are you open for dinner? Yes. Do you sell any food for dinner? Yes. Open to changing the name. And he said, actually, if we have to in North America. But I got used to it very quickly. I'll tell you a couple things about Pepper Lunch. The idea behind it is that in 1994, beef was very inaccessible. It was very expensive to the average consumer in Japan. And our founder wanted to, as a fine dining master chef, he wanted to make finer meats available to the average consumer in Japan. And so the idea of the name is pepper for pepper, beef pepper rice or the pepper rice dish genre. And then lunch to evoke the idea that you can have this meal, you can have beef at any time of the day at lunch prices. We all assume lunch prices, we're used to lunch prices being less than dinner prices in the same venues, especially casual and finer dining restaurants, right? So he just amalgamated the name to Pepper Lunch. Believe it or not, in all of our stores, the dinner day part represents anywhere from 50 to 55% of sales. So in some cases, we actually sell more at dinner than we do at lunch. And they're almost all very equal. We're talking about a swing of about 48 to 57% on either day part. Pretty fascinating. People, the name doesn't seem to get folks. The last thing I'll say about the name, and again, when I mentioned, you know, maybe we could do a different name in the US, a version of it. We actually have versions of this in Asia called Pepper Lunch To Go, Pepper Lunch Express. We actually have a Pepper Kitchen because of some promises we make on the brand side about being halal in Asia. So if you can't do a halal store, certified store, then we call it a Pepper Kitchen instead of a Pepper Lunch. So they've been very flexible with that. But the reality is 30 years of history in 15 countries puts us in a position that we have really, really great brand awareness among the Asian communities of the world. And because we've been challenged to find folks over 15 or so years old, any Asian ethnicity background person, whether they were raised here, first generation, second generation or not, they know the name. They're familiar with it. They've heard about it. They've eaten it. And quite frankly, if you've been in the United States military and or you've been a student traveling abroad or been to an Asian-based university program for, say, travel semester abroad or something, many, many Americans have been exposed to pepper lunch and find it as kind of like an everyday food that they really enjoyed while they were there. So there's a lot of brand familiarity and affinity to the brand. So I'm excited that it took me about 3 weeks, but I got over it and I got comfortable and used to it. But it's fun to sort of just talk about it. It is sort of an icebreaker of what is this thing? Pepper lunch? What is that? And but man, once people know it and love it, they start telling everybody about it. So
yeah, it's a great explanation. Yeah, for sure. Now I understand it better. So my colleague, Lisa Jennings, she wrote about how Pepper Lunch is developing a better process for to-go orders. So can you describe that? I know it's in the works, but is there anything that you can talk about?
Yeah, on the to-go program, today it is one of the issues for us in regards to operational efficiency. We do have to use the current iron plate to mix your food the way you've prescribed it on your to-go order or takeaway order or delivery order. We are working on an R&D process now in our test kitchen in Singapore, where we're using what are called rotating kettle woks. If you imagine an iron cylinder at about a 40 degree angle on top of a box that is programmable, sort of like computer meets medieval device, this is a device we can control speed, temperature, and time. And so we can sear and then reduce speed up rotation, et cetera. There's quite a few concepts in Australia. There's been some concepts here that we've actually worked on in the United States that have used these. And so we're familiar with them. So we're in the process, beginning process of testing our menu and programming the machine to confirm that, does it work better? Does it create a better end product? And does it work faster or more efficiently so that maybe we can have one person man a third make station or a backline off-premise make station designated for this purpose? And so we've designed that into the new model, and we're working with these materials and these machines to sort of reformulate the process to make sure that we can replicate our existing product that goes out to the guest in the dining room. We expect to wrap that up early in Q1, probably be able to start rolling that out by the beginning of Q2. We've married that with a complete reimagination and reevaluation of our to-go packaging. Mm-hmm. I actually have a 3D printed prototype on my kitchen counter right now that I have to evaluate and talk with the team about. But we are looking at replicating the in-store experience with the packaging itself. Certainly you're not going to be able to sizzle it on the iron plate at home, but giving you that visual and physical experience like you would have in the store of using the iron plate style shape and size container, but also making sure that our food makes it from store to destination. And as you know, that's an average of 15 to 20 minutes in the United States. So we want to make sure that it's when you receive it, it's in great condition and most closely approximates the product that you might be able to have in store. So we're taking this a holistic approach from in-store operational design, in-store equipment, cooking equipment and process, recipe evaluation, if there need to be adjustments to have the end product result. And then certainly looking at packaging from what kind of bag, what kind of steam escape mechanisms and things like this to make sure that that end product gets to you. And so when we feel like we're good and we've tested it and the consumer says it's great, then we will go really, really loud with our marketing for off-prem. I really think there's a massive lift for us. You know, today in the United States, we're between 7 and 10%. Most of the world, we're around 10 to 15% off-premise. We do have some pockets in Asia that are up to 30% because it's sort of a demand community that requires it and they've adjusted and accepted it that way. But for us, we want to make it as efficient for our franchisees and operators, but also make sure that product ends up in the right condition at home. So we're excited. I'm very excited about the possibilities from a business perspective, and certainly to be able to expose this brand and this experience to more people who may not take that first step by walking in our four walls.
Cool. It sounds really very high tech. So I understand that you also see universities as an opportunity for expansion. Do you have any locations in mind yet, or is this just the planning stages?
Every major university in America is in mind. Yeah, you know, a couple things driving that. We are very, very experienced in the food court, food mall, multi-food venue complexes in Asia. Most of our venues would fall in that. Even the restaurant model type, the full 1,500, 1,600 to 1,700 square foot can be inside of these mall type venues or these large aggregate community venues, which is very common in Asia, Singapore, Japan, certainly Hong Kong, and throughout. So we're very experienced in this reduced model size, this high efficiency, small footprint, which lends us to be very flexible to go into environments like airports and universities here in North America. But the main driver is that we discovered in our research about the 5.5 years here in North America is that 60% of our guests are under 35. And when we talk to folks about the brand, we find folks who have teenage to college age children telling us consistently every day, yeah, my kids are fascinated with the Asian culture, whether it's anime or manga or the cuisine or the language, et cetera. They're fascinated. They're making more and more friends of Asian backgrounds. They're just really engaging and authentic about their curiosity. And so they're seeking these things out. And obviously, that's driving the Asian cuisine growth in North America, which is the fastest growing niche cuisine type in North America for the last couple of years. You know, obviously, sushi has been around a long time, but has really taken off in the last 10 years. Ramen has really taken off in the last 5 years. Now we're seeing Korean barbecue really take adoption at pretty high rates. I've seen some great numbers out of some of those brands. And so all that's being driven by the younger generation. And so that tells us that, you know, the university environment is going to be great for us for a long term, because we have multiple generations now that are coming up much more familiar, much more adventurous with their food choices and curiosities. In addition to that, the young folks, you know, are doing more congregating and spending more outside of the home on food. They're growing up really not cooking or eating homemade meals overall, right? Not like many of us that are over 40, I'll just say for myself. And so we see a long-term growth trajectory as these next generations age up into having disposable income of their own. And so if we're capturing them at the university today, then we're going to get that early first job, independent single person, and then they're going to move into family. And so we're going to be able to see this sort of growth trajectory starting now in that age group. The last thing I'll say is that if most people aren't aware, most major universities in the United States have a very significant Asian population, driven mostly by Chinese folks from mainland and Hong Kong and even Taiwan as well. But we're seeing a lot of Japanese youngsters do come here for university, whether it's a short-term program or the full four-year coursework. And so, you know, you have universities like Yale University, which is 40% Asian population, and many, many universities around America are well over 20% Asian student population. So they know the brand, they're familiar with the food type, and certainly if we're on campus, they're going to introduce it to their friends who are not of their background to bring them on and show them something they're proud and have access to.
Yeah, it sounds like a no-brainer for sure. So you did talk a lot about what's, you know, happening in the near future, but going into 2024, just to wrap it up, do you have any other plans for Pepper Lunch that you want to talk about? That we didn't talk about
location,
yet?
Location. You know, we announced already here just recently that we found a fantastic multi-unit partner in Arizona. They're going to open 10 stores in Arizona, starting with as many as 3 locations over the next 18 to 20 months. We are getting very close to announcing several more states, getting 10 plus locations over the next few years. Our growth trajectory is very aggressive because our concept is so well established. Our build process is well established. Our supply chain is incredibly well established. We can support franchisees who are well-resourced infrastructure-wise and financially to go fast. And so we are on a accelerated growth path over the next 3 to 5 years. You know, and I say that we're only going to open 6 to 10 stores next year, and then 20 the year after, and 30 the year after that. But we will get to a cadence where we're selling 100 plus stores a year, and we're opening 30 to 50. And so for any brand, that's a very big lift, and that's a lot of work. So for me internally, we're building, continuing to build out the corporate infrastructure in North America, which today is robust, but we are augmenting that. We are bringing brand intelligence and brand knowledge over from Asia. We're having folks move here, come spend time here permanently. And so we're really internally building to support that growth. Really focused on our first to market franchisees, getting them off the ground extremely successfully, spending a lot of time thinking about saturating the market with messaging and imagery and understanding of what this is that's coming. And once we're there, we want to really support pushing folks in to give it a try. So that is really what the next couple of years looks like for us. Of course, we have the menu program and the off-premise program. We are adding couple of different beverage programs, an announcement to come this week. Pat, I'll give you the breaking news if you like, if you can just wait a week to push this out. We're bringing in Tractor Beverage, which is an all natural, organic, no GMO restaurant or industry only beverage product. Very high quality, very refreshing frescas. We're doing the Fresca program. And so we're going to have a bubbler, a 3-container bubbler, and have 3 fantastic flavors. I was so thrilled that they had flavors that already really paired well with our food. They have a mandarin cardamom fresca. They have a strawberry dragon fruit fresca, and we're doing a green mint tea. It's a no sugar added green mint tea as well. And so we're adding to our beverage program. We're bringing beer back in almost all of Asia. We do Kirin beer over there. They actually do self-pour. We won't be doing self-pour here in America, but we're going to do a bottle program with Kirin Ichiban and Kirin Light, which only exists here in the United States. So we'll be bringing that on with our new stores as well. So yeah, we're always looking at innovating, not only on the menu and being relevant on price, but also focused on technology as we roll out our new tech stack in North America and throughout Asia. We've got a lot going on for sure.
Thanks so much, Troy. Sounds like Pepper Lunch is one to watch as we move into 2024. You can download this episode of Menu Feed and past podcasts on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Pat Kobe.